I've always been looking for simpler ways to do things. I think like a lot of engineers are trying to find simpler ways to do things. And yeah, trying out different programming models and whatnot. I guess there's like a quote, I rather write programs to help people write programs than write programs.
This is Contributor, a podcast telling the stories behind the best open source projects and the communities that make them. I'm Eric Anderson. Today we get to talk with Matt Wanlaw, who's kind of the creator and principal at Vulcan Labs. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here.
I don't know if you've ever called yourself the principal of Vulcan Labs. I just made that up.
Yeah, no, I guess founder, but it's a one-man show, so titles don't mean much.
We're going to talk about all the things Vulcan Labs does. One of those things is an open source project, CR SQLite. We've talked a lot about SQLite on the show lately, so excited to have you. But I want to start actually maybe with Vulcan Labs, because I think that's the right umbrella for this conversation. You're living the dream in many respects. Tell us about what Vulcan Labs is and how you got into it.
Yeah, so you know, I just think software is too hard to write. The first 80% starts pretty easy. You know, as the saying goes, you do that last 20%. And for some reason, it takes forever and everything turns into spaghetti code. And I was trying to figure out, like, what is it that makes software so hard to write? Is it just like engineers are bad and like we need to study harder? Or is it the tools we're using are the wrong abstractions for the job? They're just not like up to today's applications. I came to the conclusion that just like the tooling is wrong. And I guess Vulcan Labs is my experiments and explorations and what should the modern dev stack for kind of rich applications like a Figma or a Notion or Spotify, like if you were to build those, what primitives do you need to build those? And I guess like as a preview, like the solutions I've landed on are CR SQLite. It's basically an extension for SQLite that lets you merge databases. So think of like Git for databases in a way. So that's to facilitate like collaboration and multiplayer. The other is Materialite. So this is bringing incremental view maintenance to embedded databases. Because, you know, a lot of queries, you want to be able to subscribe to a query rather than always being request response. Because in like a UI, you want to know instantaneously what has changed rather than every time somebody makes a change, requerying the database. And then the last two things, one is like tree SQL. So I think the relational model is the right model. But how, if you're using a relational model, how do you pull like a tree of data out? Because a lot of times your application, it needs a hierarchy, not some flat set of relations. So if you think like an issue tracker, you might have an issue and that issue has labels and maybe it has comments. You might want to pull those as one document. And yeah, and the last thing is better integration between the host language and the database. So you have like full static typing end to end.
The high level idea of like, software is still too hard to write is I think a good first principle. I think we can all agree. Is there some fundamental kind of reason for that? Or is this just a blocking and tackling exercise? We just need to make it easier in a thousand different ways.
Object orientation is a big culprit, I think. So I think when we model our data with OO, we're bringing some implicit assumptions to the data that we don't realize. So like one example is a chair, right? You're going to model a chair in your program. You're going to say your chair is a piece of furniture. Well, that classification of chair as furniture is very dependent on the perspective of the viewer or the person using the chair. Like, yeah, in my normal life, a chair is a piece of furniture, sure. But if it's really cold outside and like I don't have heat, maybe my chair is firewood. Or if I need to break out of the office, maybe my chair is a battering ram. Need to block a door, maybe the chair's a barricade. Like it has all these different roles depending on the context of the viewer. And I think software, as it gets older, gets new requirements that change those fundamental perspectives. And your data model, when it's this OO way, is not flexible enough to adapt to that. So I think like OO is one culprit. Can we code directly to relations? And that got me started down the relational DB path. And then I realized like there's other problems here, but like relational databases are built for this era of request response. Like you think about the early LAMP stack kind of world, where every time a user visited a site, you would request from the database, get all the data and show stuff. Whereas if you're building some rich UI like a Spotify, you don't want to have to request to the database every time you make a state change. Like every time a state change happens, it should just update, kind of like call you back reactively.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where the Materialite project was born of SQLite, and these databases are still in this request response paradigm. They really need a subscription paradigm where I can say, set up all my queries that my app needs and subscribe to them. Because yeah, like applications have a very static set of queries. Like if you think about WhatsApp, it has a query for your threads, your messages, your contact list. And those queries don't change every time you open the app. It's really the data that's changing, the queries that are static. So for these sort of apps, you need a database that really handles the static query case and dynamically changing data case.
So you have this broader kind of realization that software could be easier in a lot of ways. And you start identifying these culprits, mapping them into projects. Was this all happening before you started Vulcan? Or did you kind of leave to start Vulcan and you're like, now what do I do? And kind of happen into this? How long has this been kind of a motivator for you?
Ever since I started coding, I've always been looking for simpler ways to do things. I think like a lot of engineers are trying to find simpler ways to do things. And yeah, trying out different programming models and whatnot. I guess there's like a quote, I rather write programs to help people write programs than write programs. If that makes sense. Like I rather write infrastructure for people. I was doing a lot of that at Facebook and whatnot, but I just wanted to do something that had broader applicability to like the whole world. It could be open sourced. So in that, after I had my first child, I was like thinking in my head, what am I going to tell him? Like how to live his life? And I was like, oh, I'm not living this life, I would tell him. Yeah, I took the plunge and decided to leave my job. But yeah, I've always been sort of like, I don't know, the FIRE movement of like aggressively saving and stuff. Being at FANG for 8 years, like I had enough to just take that plunge. I was fortunate enough to be able to do that and work on this stuff full time.
People tell themselves, you know, oh, if I had, you know, more financial security, I would do X or Y. That's my true passion. And I challenge them a bit, like, well, if that, you know, is this true passion of yours really so commercially inviable? And because presumably that passion probably produces some value for society. And I think most people, when they realize it, they're like, yeah, actually, if I did, you know, do this thing I love, it wouldn't be so terrible. And it sounds like you kind of came to that conclusion eventually.
Yeah. Like that was part of the motivator. It's like, if I quit, I'm doing something. It's going to produce money at some point. It's not like I'm going to be living on my savings forever. And I think, yeah, after a year and a half in, some people found CR SQLite, Fly.io specifically, and they like did a pretty significant sponsorship. And then some people found Materialite and were like, oh, like, we need this in our database. And yes, like contract to hire. So yeah, like money is coming in and it's more than I expected. So yeah, it's been pretty good.
I'm curious, now that you've been through this, Matt, what you think about the future. I'm remembering one of your tweets where you kind of thought, oh, you know, like a lot of people are chasing this problem area now. Maybe it's time for me to move on to something else. I get the impression that you see yourself as kind of operating at the frontier.
Yeah, so what I spent most of my time on was CR SQLite, which is this concept of, can you model SQLite tables with CRDTs so that you can merge databases? The idea would be like, this would make collaborative software or software that can go offline and come back online really easy for developers. Like they don't have to understand CRDTs themselves. They don't have to understand syncing. They just like set up their table, say this table is like last write wins, or this column is last write wins. This column is some text CRDT, and they just write to their database, and the database handles all the merging for them. And when I started that project, I think there's just like AutoMerge and YJS. Those are two other kind of projects in the space of like CRDTs and collaboration and data syncing. But then, yeah, I guess like a year later, we saw Electric SQL, PowerSync, SQL Sync, Replicache. There's like endless entrants into this like data syncing space. And yeah, I guess like, I've never really questioned myself, like, why do I feel like once it's saturated, I need to move on? I guess I feel like other people are solving it. There's a more interesting stuff to solve next. So yeah, after I saw so many people kind of working on that problem, I knew in like my own apps and apps people have been writing with CR SQLite, there was this question of, I'm using SQLite as my data store, but I have to build this like object model on top because I want to be able to react in real time to mutations. So I was like, okay, this seems like a problem where we could have incremental views and subscriptions where you could subscribe to your queries rather than having to create this separate layer to handle notifications of writes. So that's kind of like where I got into incremental view maintenance and Materialite.
You and I have talked a little bit about SQLite, and then on the show, we've covered quite a bit. And I want to make sure we cover as much as you're interested in covering on SQLite, because I think it's been an interesting ecosystem for the last little bit. What have you found interesting, or you know, what are some topics we should cover today?
Well, I guess my latest conclusion is SQLite might not be the right fit for today's like Figmas or Notions, like the next set of rich UIs. And why I think that is because, as I said earlier, like if you think of an application, the queries are pretty static and the data is what's dynamic. What we really want is a facility for doing subscriptions against the database. Like for the WhatsApp example, I have a query for my messages, a query for my threads, a query for user status. I just want to subscribe to all those. And anytime that data changes, notify me so I can update the UI. With SQLite right now, you can't subscribe to anything, right? You've got to like either pull on some interval, or you've got to add some layer on top of the database to handle this for you. And once you add a layer on top of the database, you end up with all the same problems that DB was solving for you, right? Like a database gives you nice transactions and concurrency control, but if you're going to add a new layer on top, well, you're going to have to think about transactions and concurrency control and implement all that there. So it would be better if it was in the DB itself. And then, I don't know, I guess I briefly touched on like the object model is the wrong one. It'd be great if you just code directly to relations. I think that might be a little wild idea to some people, but if you are coding directly to relations, you need your database to be kind of like as fast as memory. So like when you write, it finishes as fast as setting a variable. When you read, it's as fast as reading like a variable off the JavaScript heap if you're like using JS. And SQLite, where every transaction, when you commit it, has to be durably committed before you can like do another operation. Yeah, I think that's a fundamental problem for if you want to like just code directly to relations, where like I don't think all commits need to be durably committed before you like move on to do the next commit. Because there's plenty of cases in an application where it's fine if like you lose the last few commits. Like if you think of like Spotify or something, right? Like not every single interaction needs to be durable immediately. And if you can get rid of that durability for every single commit, you can go a lot faster.
Maybe I shouldn't ask this question. What does this coding directly to relations mean? Is this kind of like a graph-like idea, or to map it with terms that I've explored before?
Yeah, so I guess if we think of Spotify, you have your tracks, you have your play button, you have your timeline of what's currently where you are in the track. Somehow you have to get the data to those components, right? The essentially the play state. So when you press play, like all the things can update and show the correct state. And if you're using like an object model, maybe you're like passing that down to all the components. But if you're like coding directly against like some relational DB where everything's like flat and laid out, this like global data store, well, every component can just issue a query for the data it needs. So it's literally just issuing some query for the data it needs and then subscribing to that query. And I guess like coding to relations has less of this perspective problem of like that chair example of if I need to find something that's firewood, well, I can just query for anything that's made of wood and like chairs will come back and that's fine.
Maybe it's worth pointing out one of the things that's interesting about what you're doing, I think it's kind of orthogonal to the way a lot of the software is developed today, which is individuals have a specific problem in a company. They build some software to solve that specific problem, and then they explore whether it can be generalized to a lot of people. And I think you've kind of separated yourself from a specific application and said, here's a general problem. Can I come up with a general solution and then explore whether it can apply to certain people's specific problems? Is that fair to say you're kind of taking the reverse approach to, say, Uber open source or Google open source?
No, I started. So I guess like I'm pulling on my like, been doing software development for 15 years and like I've noticed these recurring patterns in all the sorts of systems we've had to build. So I guess it's like pulling on this like history of experience and these problems I know I keep dealing with and thinking through like why does state management keep coming up as a problem? Like why is model view controller always turn into a mess eventually? And I do have this old project I used to use. It's like devalidate and test my ideas. It's strut.io. It's like this old presentation editor. Yeah, there's some grounding in reality and a use case.
Okay, so you went down the SQLite journey, built CR SQLite, Fly got excited. But over time, you kind of came to the conclusion that maybe SQLite isn't the right abstraction. Have you come to similar conclusions for your other projects?
So I guess the short answer is not really. I think the other projects are still seem like they're bearing a lot of fruit. Kind of SQLite, I had reservations at the beginning, but like the old adage of like, don't write your own database and all these things. Coming from Facebook, where they're very pragmatic about how they do things, I was like, yeah, that kind of culture was instilled in me. So like, let me make the pragmatic choice here. Let me pull SQLite off the shelf and see how far I can get with it. And then just after a while, it's like, yeah, I don't think it's going to get all the way to where I want to get it to. And I think part of that is I've been targeting the web platform specifically, and I just didn't realize how much of a tax there is crossing from JavaScript to WASM and back. And like, there's a huge performance hit just in that. Yeah. And maybe if that performance hit wasn't there, I could still continue with SQLite. I'm not sure.
Do you come out the other door then? You know, if SQLite isn't the answer, is there something else you lean towards?
What I'm leaning towards is just like fully investing my time in MaterialLite and building that up to just not just be incremental view maintenance, but also a regular database under the hood. Yeah, I'm leaning into, yeah, I guess I will build my own database. The upside of that is like MaterialLite actually has like the most interest from people financially. So it makes sense for me to do that too.
I've noticed a little database trend of late where folks seem to not build databases from scratch in the form factor we're used to as much anymore, as they borrow this from Postgres or that from ClickHouse, and that database ends up being kind of a federation of database components than like a single monolith. And I'm curious, you know, as you approach MaterialLite, is that going to bear out or?
Yeah, I think so. So that's also one of the things that, you know, finally pushed me over the edge. So maybe I can build my own. I don't know. I feel so arrogant saying this. Maybe I can build my own database, but like, I guess that's why we do hard things, right? We do them because we don't know they're hard. But yeah, there's a guy at Triplet, I think their founder, he's like, yeah, building a database probably isn't that hard these days because you have all these key value stores and B-tree implementations. Like, you can just pull stuff, as you said, off the shelf. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. And like, the browser has IndexedDB, which is a pretty decent abstraction for a key value store to base the database off of. So like, I don't have to solve the writing to disk and the durability and all these things. I just really am dealing with that key value interface. Everything below that is already solved for me.
If MaterialLite goes the way you want, is this a database in the sense of like a local database, like a SQLite, or is this like a distributed database? I don't need Postgres anymore.
It'll be a local embedded database like SQLite,
okay,
but ideally with collaborative features, right? Like, I think SQLite was built in a time where everybody kind of just had one computer, but now, right, like, you have multiple devices and you might start work on your phone, mm-hmm, and like continue, yep, it on your laptop and then finish it later back on your phone. And you want that data obviously to sync between all of them. So I think, yeah, it'd be really cool if an embedded database of the future kind of knew how to sync or merge itself with other copies of itself. So you do. Yeah. Cause I guess like going back to strut.io, when I first quit, I was like, oh, I think I can resurrect this old project and make a bunch of money real quick with it. But that project didn't have multiplayer or syncing. So I was like, okay, let me just go add that real quick. And I was like, oh, like, this is a mess. And that's why, like, I think there's a market here with CRSQLite. And that's how I started building CRSQLite. Like, I think there's a market. Let me just go build that general solution. So all that to say is, like, syncing's hard. It would be great if something like at the database layer could handle that for developers, so they don't have to be like experts in distributed systems.
So I guess this transition, if I'm imagining, there is kind of one happening between your focus on CRSQLite to MaterialLite, kind of reinforces the fact that Vulkan Labs is the thing that's persistent and continuous. That's where you're being consistent, and then you kind of move the locus of attention from one project to the other as needs arise, as conclusions form. Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess I started, it was really just Vulkan, and it was all going to be a product around CRSQLite. And I kind of realized, like, I really enjoy solving the difficult problems and not so much the, yeah, finding collaborators, maybe finding funding, maybe hiring people, like the whole business side building. So I was like, okay, pivoting it as like a research lab and doing contract work for people who also have these problems. It fits my interest, and too, like, it provides some like financial stability.
Maybe one question going back to this object-oriented is the big culprit. And you mentioned relations to the model. And I think I got that with respect to data modeling and your database. Does that also mean you would avoid objects in kind of more just general programming, like classes are problematic What's the alternative? Is it functional, or is there some other approach?
Yeah, I don't think classes are altogether bad, right? I think you still need classes and objects and all these things for
abstraction and encapsulation, maybe.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think of the best way to, like, there is a separation somewhere. There's like the data for the problem domain you're modeling, and I feel like that should be relational. And then there's like the data for like your algorithms, maybe your B-tree or your breadth first traversal or whatever these things are. Like, these can be classes and hide their data and have interfaces and whatnot. But the stuff that's part of the problem domain feels like it should be stored in a relational DB and accessed directly through queries. I guess one other thing that the kind of like object model or program memory is missing, like, is good primitives for doing mutations. So if you think about a database, you can start a transaction, you can mutate 5 things. If you fail in the middle, well, they all get rolled back. They think about like your program memory. If you start a bunch of mutations and then you have an exception in the middle, like, you don't really have a facility to roll back. A few languages have software transactional memory, but like not many. And I think that's another big problem as to like people always say, oh, like global state is a horrible thing. But like our databases are shared global mutable state, right? And like we generally don't have that many problems with them. And I think it's like the primitives in our languages are just the wrong, we don't have the right mutation primitives. Like, we can't do a transaction. We can't get isolation of transactions. We can't roll things back. Yeah, I should be able to go like say, I want to mutate these 5 variables, but nobody should be able to see the effects of the mutation until I'm done. And if I fail in the middle, I should be able to revert to the prior state. But yeah, we don't have that in like JavaScript or, you know, C or whatever.
Interesting. And maybe we don't have those things because the database has done that for us in the past. Like we've just said, the database is the record of truth for this data, and we're going to outsource mutation management to the database. And now as we want to do more of that state management within our programming more directly, do you envision that emerging? Is this the 5th project for Vulkan Labs?
So I think like in the early 2000s, you're right? Like when pages were like the LAMP stack and everything was a full page refresh, all your state was in the database and that was the system of record. And you had no like in-memory state you had to manage and roll back and do all these things with. I think things were pretty easy back then. And I guess to answer your other question, like, would I ever do software transactional memory? So I know Clojure has it. They've had it for a really long time. JavaScript, I don't know, the environment seems so impure. It seems like super hard to pull that off. I don't know if you could pull that off in user space.
So Matt, what, maybe we can just touch a bit more on the Vulkan Labs model, because I think it's an interesting model. So you went into this thinking, I'm just going to create value, solve big problems. And if people want to fund me, great. And if not, we'll figure it out. And people did want to fund you. How does that happen? Like, what are the mechanics? Because I think that's interesting to some people. They just send you dollar bills in the mail?
Yeah, I wish it was that easy. Like, okay, some people send you dollar bills in the mail, but literally like $5 a month.
Right.
To get like worthwhile sponsorships. Yeah, it was just like actually talking with the company. So like finding out which companies were using the stuff. Usually they were talking to me in Discord because they needed support. And then finding out like, who are they? Okay, they're part of a company. And then just literally having that conversation, like, it looks like this powers one of your products. I'm doing a lot of bug fixes and maintaining things for you. I think it would be fair if you guys contributed a significant amount to this. Yeah, so Johannes, he's a guy I talked to. He encouraged me to say like, oh, like, are you getting one engineer's salary worth of value out of this? That's how much you should contribute. I never went quite that aggressive. So I went somewhere like between, yeah, $0 to that aggressive. And yeah, like just having those conversations, being upfront that like they're getting value. And like, what's the worst that could happen, right? Like they can say no, but they're probably still going to use your project. They're not just going to drop it. I did wait, right? Like I didn't like ask for these donations immediately. I waited till the project was kind of in use in some capacity at their company before like asking, which it feels a bit sleazy. Like, oh, I waited till you like deployed to production. Now I'm asking you for money. But I think everybody understands that you got to make a living somehow.
Yeah, I don't think it's terrible to deliver value and then ask for money. I mean, it'd be almost, the reverse seems also equally strange to be like, I think you should pay me and just hope that I give you something interesting in the
That's
end.
That's true.
And these people are accommodating. And do you have Are there strings attached to that money? Do you implicitly need to like serve their needs, or do they ask for deliverables?
Yeah, it's different for different companies. Some are no strings attached. It's like, we're using it. We know how to use it. Whatever support you can provide is fine, but we're not holding it to anything. There have been others that like, oh, we want to give you equity and like make sure you're aligned with our company's success and sign this contract. And I mean, those I just kind of have to turn down because like,
okay, yeah,
I feel like if I'm going to start tying myself to one specific sponsor, then that might preclude others in the future. And now I'm like suddenly worried about what I say publicly or work on in the future, right? Yeah, for those, I just say like, yeah, I can't do that. You need to just like, you can just write a sponsorship check or nothing at all. I don't know if you've talked to others in the past who get open source sponsorships, if you, you know, have any insights into what other people have done.
You know, GitHub now facilitates some donations, and I think Patreon is another kind of channel that I've seen people use. In the case of maybe both of those, there's an option to do kind of like a reoccurring, like I'm going to subscribe to a donation, like I'm going to give you $10 a month, which is an interesting model. We've all seen the phrasing around like buy me a coffee, which is kind of a fun, you know, it seems like, you know, if Matt was in person, I definitely would buy him a coffee. I imagine in most cases, your sponsors are buying you much more than that. But do you incorporate as like a nonprofit? Like, are you kind of like Mozilla Foundation in a small way?
Yeah, these are very good questions. I should talk to somebody like who deals with this and to give me some advice. But right now I'm just set up as an LLC. But yeah, I don't know. Could I set up as a nonprofit, get better tax benefits? Or yeah, I know there's like research tax credits and stuff.
Good. So Matt, I want to pause here because we're approaching end of time. Anything you wanted to cover or that would be good to cover?
I think the last thing that's interesting to me is like, you have like an embedded database which has some set of data on it, but like realistically, you probably have, I guess people have all sorts of different devices with different storage. You have your phone and then your like laptop and desktop. So like the amount of data in your app on your phone is probably gonna be a sliver of what might be on your desktop. So like it's really interesting of like, can you create a embedded replicated database where on the phone it just has this hot set that the phone is using, but on the desktop it has like the full set, and can you do queries that kind of span both databases where like, oh, it'll query my data locally, and then if there's more data, it'll go back to like the server or whatever and pull in the rest.
Maybe jamming on that a little bit more broadly, I don't think this is anything new, but I novel all the time when I look through my apps on my phone that I have like gigabytes of app on my phone, but very little of my user data. People build apps, they ship them to my phone, and then on my phone, I generate data and I ship it to their server. And they store my data and I store their app. And I find that a little odd. I kind of feel like I should keep my data, you keep your app. Somehow that's not how mobile is built today. You're describing something more nuanced, which is, you know, how is this user data persisted and some of it stored on my client? On desktop, we're okay with lots of it being stored. And on mobile, you kind of want a little more flexibility to like only store what's needed in a critical sense.
Yeah, so on mobile, only store what's needed, but like, how can we hide that complexity from the developer where they're not like having to figure out what to store or not? Like maybe as they query the database, it sees what you're querying and it pulls in what you need locally. And anything you didn't query stays on the server or desktop, wherever your user data is. Because I guess, I don't know, if, like the local first movement, right? Like there's this whole movement called local first where it's like users should have all their data on device and all their user data there. But all the solutions in the local first space require you like syncing all of your data to the app before you can start using it. And I mean, some people in that space say like, oh, you're never going to generate enough user data to fill your phone. Like phones are huge now. Maybe that's true. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree, but I feel like you do need the ability to start your app with just the slice of user data you need that moment. And as you need it, start syncing it in from, I don't know, your desktop, or maybe you have some service provider that you do let you store like your aggregate of user data.
I feel like local first is often useful for like single player applications. And I just wonder, like, are they just as useful for these multiplayer applications? Do you, in this sense, you bring the whole enterprise's data onto your device?
Yeah, so that's that's where these like local first solutions have sort of been breaking down, right? Like they are good for single player. They are good for multiplayer up to an extent, right? But then once you get, yeah, I don't know, all of Boeing or Lockheed Martin or something, right? Like that's a whole enterprise. You're not going to seek down the whole enterprise wiki and enterprise task tracker and whatever else there is. So yeah, I think in that case where you do have kind of enterprise software where you want it to be snappy and fast, where all the data that your employees are using are local on your device, like you do need to somehow figure out how to just sync a subset of the enterprise. Like just what that user commonly uses day to day is synced to their device and local for them.
Maybe I'm asking you for a hot take here. You know, if you're spending less time in SQLite at the moment, have you come across PGLite? This kind of like running Postgres on Wasm on the client. Is that a thing that we should be keeping an eye on?
I've seen it. It looks really cool. I was like super blown away. They got the Wasm size down to like 2.6 megs after compression. I'm like, Postgres is that small? I had no idea. I don't know if they like rip stuff out. Yeah, I'm super curious. I want to see some benchmarks. Yeah, it's the Electric SQL folks. I think Neon working on it. So I know them pretty well. But also like I have enough going on. I don't want to distract myself with a new rabbit hole. So
yeah.
I think I'll probably just get a TLDR and try to just file that away for some future problem if it ever comes up.
Well, Matt, I think we're also maybe in kind of conclusion here, glad not only is your son, you know, the beneficiary of you kind of going rogue here with Vulcan Labs, but I think all the world, you know, rather than have there being more code in Facebook, we have more code in public, and you're solving generalized problems that all programmers face. So thanks for your contributions. I'm excited to see where it takes you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You can subscribe to the podcast and check out our community Slack and newsletter at contributor.fyi. If you like the show, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Eric Anderson, and this has been Contributor.